You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And we are fortunate to have back with us today Philip Goldberg. Philip is a public speaker, meditation teacher, and ordained interfaith minister. He hosts the Spirit Matters podcast. He has been studying the spiritual traditions of India for nearly 50 years as a practitioner, teacher, and writer. He was a transcendental meditation teacher in the 1970s and helped start Maharishi International University. He has written numerous books, including the award-winning American Veda. He was on a Better World radio show in December 2023 talking to us about his biography on the life of Paramahansa Yogananda. And today, Philip is with us to talk about his latest book, Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. Philip Goldberg, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you, McNair. Good to be back with you.
Thank you. So let me first ask you, why did you want to write a book about karma?
Well, we both want there to be a better world. And it hadn't been working out quite the way some of us wanted it to. Well, that's peripheral. The true story is I've been interested in the subject for decades. You mentioned, you know, that I've been practitioner and student of Indian spiritual teachings for many, many years. And karma is an integral part of that. I actually struggled with whether I could buy it or not. And over the years, I noticed that people were using the term more and more in just everyday speech, in newscasts, sports reports, sitcoms, popular songs. And I thought, this concept that the universe operates under laws of cause and effect that apply not just to material objects like physics studies, but to human behavior, human speech, and everything that, to use the biblical phrase, we reap what we sow. That seems to ring a bell with people, even if they don't act as if it were true. And that sort of inconsistency was intriguing to me. And over time, as it began to be used more and more, I kept thinking, why is this the case? And why is it misused and misunderstood so often? So I had the idea to do a book on it, and I had the title. But it took years and years. You know, I kept putting it off, and every once in a while, my wife or my agent would say, what about that book on karma? And I wasn't sure about it. And then Taylor Swift made a song called Karma. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, that does it. You know, some. and you know, every time it shows up on a T-shirt or the news or something, I say, it's interesting that people should be in the West, to some degree or another, accepting that karma is a real thing, but they misunderstand it a lot mm-hmm. and misuse it. So somebody. Mm-hmm. But to get back to the better world, I did think, and I still do, that if people were to act as if karma were real, even if they don't fully embrace the universality of it, the world would be a better place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've got a more detailed question about that particular aspect of it a little bit later on. Can you tell us about a little bit more about the spiritual path that you've followed in your life?
Oh, sure. I followed no spiritual path for the first portions of it. I was raised by atheists who thought religion was the opium of the people, and there was no sense of spirituality or anything in my home, just good behavior and ethical thinking and good, you know, moral basis. But then in the 60s, I was a dissatisfied young man trying to figure out how to live in the world and why the world was such a mess, and was involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war Vietnam War movement and trying to do what I can. But my personal life was a bit a mess. And in the search for understanding and meaning and answers to important questions, I was just dissatisfied. And in the circles I traveled pre-internet, instead of sending people links, you gave people books. And I came across certain books about Indian philosophy and about Buddhism, Vedanta philosophy and yoga and all these things, both original translations of originals and commentaries by people I respected, like Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts and some of those luminaries back then. And I was just drawn to what I saw as, which were called spiritual and mystical, but were very rational. Seems like a contradiction, but it's not, and very practical. And so I said, okay, let me learn more. And I became enamored of it all. And they all pointed to the need for putting these ideas and insights into practice in your life. And that led me to meditation, various yoga forms. And they were transformative. They changed my life. And so I became an advocate as well as a practitioner. And then my spiritual interests spread and opened up to other influences and became a kind of freelance mystic practitioner who embraces what scholars call the perennial philosophy, which is finding, you know, the kernel truths in all the world's traditions.
So let me ask you, you mentioned about some people tend to have a more superficial understanding of karma. Can you give our listeners kind of an overall idea of what is meant by karma?
Well, it really does boil down to what goes around comes around, and you reap what you sow, and all those cliches. But essentially, it's saying that there are laws of cause and effect in the universe. The physics principle that every action has an equal and opposite reaction, which applies to material objects. You could say that karma expands that to human behavior and human speech and human thought. That everything we do exerts an influence in the environment to varying degrees, and that the universe operates, it's one of the laws of the universe, like gravity, you know, and so according to the theory of karma, our actions don't only have an influence, but they reverberate back to us in some form or another at some time or another, so that in the long run, the universe is a fair and just place. That's the core of it. How it plays out gets a little more nuanced and complicated, of course, but that's the core of it. And you know, if your listeners are saying, I don't buy it, because the evidence doesn't seem to support it. And because if you really think about it, it's hard to accept that karma is real in the context of a single lifetime. It almost requires some form of continuity after the life of that, you know, the one life we're identifying with, to play out over time, because we see so much unfairness in the world. We see people, good people suffering and bad people seemingly being rewarded and being healthy and living long and all that. So it doesn't seem to, it's hard to prove, impossible to prove. But if you accept some kind of afterlife, and if you accept that there are consequences to our actions that are less obvious and less visible, so you see people who are miscreants, you know, the people who lie and cheat and do all kinds of bad things, not being held accountable, and we see it every day in the news, and seeming to prosper, while good, righteous people get sick and suffer loss and poverty and so forth. It doesn't seem like a fair place. But what's going on internally starts to balance the scales a little bit, because a lot of people who might be poor and ill have a great deal of love and light and beauty in their lives. And a lot of people who seem to be prospering and being powerful can be miserable inside and unloved and disrespected and you know, maybe haunted by guilt and haunted by fear of being caught and so forth. So there's subtleties that make it more plausible. But that had to be addressed, because I run into people all the time. What are you writing about karma for? I can't believe that, and I understand that.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's my understanding too. Is that kind of acceptance of the idea of reincarnation has to go along with it for it to make sense.
Yeah, and I feel the same way, and I'm willing to give that the benefit of the doubt, and I can't prove any of that, but it does make it easier to accept that actions have a cause and effect and come back to us if you play it out over multiple lifetimes. But to some degree, even in the context of this life, clearly what we do has an impact and comes back to us, even if you accept it on a limited basis. I always come back to, if I act as if karma is real, if I give it the benefit of the doubt, I make better decisions.
Is Hinduism the primary religion that the idea of karma can be traced back to? I know in Christianity, there are verses in the Bible that speak to this idea of karma or an eye for an eye. In fact, in Leviticus, I think it's chapter 24, there's a verse that reads, "If anyone injures his neighbor, as he has done it, shall it be done to him, fracture for fracture, eye for an eye," and so on. Is the idea found in any other of the world's religions besides Hinduism?
Well, that depends on how you define Hinduism. The scholars will argue over that. But the traditions that were born in India, that became what we call Hinduism, and became what we call Buddhism, and then spread and took on different variations, Jainism, Sikhism, all the, you know, the everything that sprang from ancient roots in the Vedic era of India. It's in the, karma is in there, and some way of understanding rebirth is in there. But you find it also in other traditions. Rabbis tell me that it's built into mystical Judaism and Kabbalah, and Christians tell me it was there in the early roots of Christianity, in the more esoteric variations of it among the desert mystics and others, the desert fathers. So in the mystical traditions, the more esoteric traditions of the major religions, you'll see evidence for it there.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Philip Goldberg, author of the recently released book, Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's Bainad Kutawi from Nepal playing the Bansuri flute. And today our guest on A Better World is Philip Goldberg, author of the book Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. Philip, just before the short break, I had brought up a question about Christianity. Why do you think that within Christianity, even though there are kind of phrases in the Bible that allude to this idea of cause and effect or karma, why has this idea of karma not taken hold like it has in other faiths? The only thing I can think of for something like karma in Christian thought is the idea of hell or purgatory.
Yes, and sometimes when you hear people speaking of, in terms like, using terms like God's will, and you see that's a kind of variation of karma. In the East, karma has a kind of a resonance with what we think of as laws of nature. It's non-personal. It's not something regulated by a deity, although it gets complicated because there are schools of Hinduism that do see it in that way or speak that way. But for the most part, it's a non-personal law of nature. Everything has an effect. They come back to us. And it's usually portrayed in non-judgmental terms. So what comes back to us isn't thought of as reward or punishment, but of just consequences that we experience as either desirable or undesirable, as either pleasure or pain, and so forth. And in the West, we've had this model of a more personalized God figure who makes decisions about who gets rewarded and who gets punished. And so you find that kind of language more than you do in the East. And so when people say it was God's will and God wanted this to happen, and God works in mysterious ways, all that sort of thing, they're essentially saying what we do has consequences, and there's a deity that presides over these things. In the East, they will say, you know, everything has consequences. And the so-called the forces of nature, the energies of nature create influences of cause and effect. That's a more mm-hmm. modern way of looking at it that seems more compatible with the scientific age. Mm-hmm. And so it was more appealing to people like me.
Now, this relates back to my earlier comment that I had a question for you related to assuming that the law of karma is real and living one's life by it. Towards the end of your book, you write that it's logical to assume that widespread belief in karma would multiply acts of generosity and kindness in the world. Yet, to me, there has to be a reason why, with the idea of karma or the notion of an eye for an eye, having been around so long, why the world isn't a different place. Is it because we can't connect the idea of karma to reincarnation, so we can't trace who we are now and what we experience now back to those lives and see how those lives create our conditions now?
We're now talking about mysteries, McNair, and all I can say is humans are humans. And if humans acted consistently with what they say they believe in, if Christians really acted as their Lord and Savior advised them to do, if Jews acted according to the moral precepts of their religion, if Hindus and Buddhists acted in their everyday lives consistently with the notion that everything they do comes back, the world would be a paradise, but people don't. We know it. And because we're driven by ego and we're driven by physical needs and we're driven by the effects of our upbringing and our pain. And so we do things that are selfish and we do things that are cruel and we do things that are self-interested. And we don't act according to the things we say we believe in. And that's a mystery I've yet to solve, but we wish it weren't so. And so we do what we can, just as people always have. Good people have always urged everybody to behave according to the ethical and moral principles of their traditions. Even secular people have ethical and moral codes that are not couched in religious terms, but are in secular terms. Mm-hmm. And we don't act consistently with them. And if we did, the world would be a better place. I said that in the last chapter, but I didn't say it's guaranteed. It's just, you know, it would be a better place if we acted as if the laws of karma were in effect and if we remembered to do so when we make decisions. Mm-hmm. But we're impulsive beings. And, you know, we're pleasure-seeking and advantage-seeking, and sometimes it gets out of hand.
Yeah, we're impulsive people, and we're slow learners, I think.
Yes.
So as I read your book, it seemed to focus primarily on the notion of individual karma. And as I think about, like, theosophical literature, one can find reference to the notion of collective karma or national karma. Are you familiar with this idea?
Oh, sure. And I address it in the last chapter. In fact, I have to write an article about that. It's fascinating. I don't want to get too into the weeds, but I just always assumed group karma, collective karma, in whatever grouping we're part of, is a real thing. But a lot of the scholars on the subject will say, no, karma, strictly speaking, can only apply to individuals because individuals have souls that are affected by karma, cause karma, and so forth. Groups do not have that kind of volition. But at the same time, they'll say, well, yes, but we're all part of groups, and everything we do affects everybody else in the group, and what they do affects what we do. And there seems to be something that one family's karma is different from another family's karma. So for all intents and purposes, we can speak as though it's real. And, you know, I just was out giving some talks, and the subject that comes up most here in the early days of 2026 is America's karma. What's going on here? What is it about America's karma that brought us to this moment in history? Those are mysteries that are beyond my comprehension. But something is afoot. And in some ways, you can trace cause and effect to groups and nations, communities, and see that there's different character and different events unfolding. So there must be something to collective karma, and something, and we have to address that. Are we now reaping the fruits of Native American genocide and slavery and all the other sins of our past, while we're also reaping the good karma of all that good things that America brought to the world? What, you know, that's beyond our comprehension. There's much about karma that you surrender to, as people in the Western religion say, just surrender to the will of God. You just have to surrender to the laws of karma and say it's incomprehensible, but we do what we can in the moment, in the present, to create a better karmic future. That's in our control.
I thought it was interesting in a section in the book where you talk about what karma is not. And I was wondering, can you kind of go over that and tell us what is not karma, or what is karma not?
Well, that addresses what I mentioned before about the popular uses of the term karma are often naive or incomplete, you could say. And so I had to address the misconceptions. And one of them is when you hear karma being used in everyday speech, it's usually when something bad happens. So people say, well, it's karma. Oh, you know, somebody rear-ended you. Oh, karma. You got sick. Bad karma. Your business hit a downfall. Bad karma. Things like that. And in popular music, it's usually, you done me wrong, and now karma's going to get you. And it's that sort of thing. You know, I'm a big sports fan. If you see the word karma come up in sports reports, it's always because somebody's losing. But the truth is, everything is karma. All the good stuff is karma. So people who believe in karma will say, oh, it's bad karma. I got sick, or, you know, my house was broken into, or whatever. But all the blessings, all the little gifts that we have that we fail to appreciate much of the time, that's karma too. Being healthy is good karma. Prospering is good karma. A gift that comes your way, you know, financial or whatever, is good karma. Being loved, you know, all these little joys and pleasures of life, that's good karma from our past. And so that's one way karma is misunderstood. The other is, and I mentioned this earlier, we think of things that happen in terms of being rewarded or punished, being rewarded when something good happens, being punished when not. The laws of karma are more non-personal and non-judgmental. They're all just consequences. They're all effects of past behavior, cause and effect. And it's not about predestination or fatalism. Karma's not fixed. We get to modify it with every word we speak, every motivation that drives our actions, everything we do. We are modifying our karma at every instant. So it's not a statement of fatalism. It's a statement of personal freedom and responsibility. It puts everything on our shoulders. So whatever happens to us, if it's an effect of our past actions, that makes us responsible. And in the moment, when something happens, how we respond to it, what we do in the next instant, the next day, the next week, creates the karma of the future. So we're free beings in that way and responsible. It's not like the stuff is happening to us. So to me, if you really understand karma, it eliminates a lot of self-pity and regret and all those things. It's just, this is what is. This is the result of a confluence of indecipherable events from the past, and we're in the moment, and we have to act in a good and proper way to create better karma going forward. Another thing it's not is an excuse, and this is a common thing in certain circles where people talk about karma. Something bad happens. You say, oh, too bad, those people, that person is undergoing some difficulties. Bad karma. And it's often just used as an excuse to be indifferent. Oh, those people are suffering. Well, it's their karma. They have to play it out. And if I interfere, you know, the karma won't be worked out. And you see that all over, you know, anywhere in the world where karma is in effect. And you see it in other systems of thought where they'll say, oh, it's God's will. God meant it to be that way. So, you know, we don't interfere, which is often just an excuse to not do something to help the situation. Yeah. You're all about making the world a better place. So if somebody, I said this the other day to somebody, I said, if somebody, you're walking in the street of a city and somebody trips and falls in front of you, you don't just say, well, it's their karma. It is their karma, but it's also their karma that you happen to be there and see it to help them. And if you don't and just say, well, it's their karma, I'm not going to interfere, what kind of karma are you creating by being so callous and indifferent and really cruel? And so we're called upon to not just understand karma is about cause and effect, but to do something.
Yeah,
and that's an important piece of it.
I just wanted to bring up a point that I once read, and just to illustrate that what you're saying. And this was written by the late British author Benjamin Grimm. He used to get questions at his lectures in regards to the hungry and starving people in the world, asking, was it not their karma to be born into such situations? And he would answer that it wasn't their karma to be born and starve to death. It's just that they happen to be born into an economic system that is not just and fair. And it seems to me that if we look at people's situation and conditions they live in and say it's karma, we do run the, like you're saying, we run the risk of washing our hands of their situation instead of trying to do something to help them. Annie Besant, who was theosophical person, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Once wrote, do not take karma as an excuse for indolence. And as I
Oh, I wish I had known that. I would have used it in the book.
Yeah, that's a great quote. Yeah.
For indolence. Yes. And she lived that. I mean, she was a fierce proponent of Indian independence, the Indian independence movement, you know, long before anybody heard Mahatma Gandhi's name. And she walked that talk.
Now, you know a lot about, I've seen, Indian society. Is this idea of washing your hands of situations, can that be seen in where people who are Dalits, who are formerly known as untouchables, either because they accept their fate as karma, or those above them in society say it's their karma to be born that way?
Yes.
It's almost like the idea of karma is used as a prison to keep people down.
And that's exactly the case. It was, and probably still is in certain aspects of that society. And so it's true. It's misused that way in the West, but it was also misused that way in the land of its birth. It's very easy for somebody in a position of superiority socially to say, well, those people beneath me, it's their bad karma, or it's their karma, good or bad, to be in the caste they're in, the social class or status they're in. And my karma is to rule over them, or to have them serve me. But then you, for some strange reason, even if you accept the stratification, some people treat those beneath them, those who serve them, with kindness and dignity, and other people are mean and cruel. So what kind of karma does those two alternatives create for the people in the superior position? People fail to do that in many cases. And in many cases, the excuse will be, or the thinking is, not just that it's my karma to be in a more advantageous position economically and with respect to status, and their karma to be in the inferior position. And because the karma has to be played out so that in a future life it evens out, those people have to suffer the consequences of that karma, and therefore I'm justified in ruling with a tough hand because it's better for them. You can make any excuse. And, we see it in the West. It's God's will. Oh, there's a hurricane and floods? God's will. Well, yes, but there are people suffering, so get out the boat and help them. But, humans are strange. But, so I'm glad you brought that up. And it, of course, applies all over the world. It's not just but it's also true that in India, they too have social progress, and those they too have. There are laws against certain things, and there are laws to even the score. Just as we have things like affirmative action and voting rights here, there's reforms in India too, to right, make up for the wrongs of the past.
Today on A Better World, we are talking to Philip Goldberg, author of the book Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. And he's host of the Spirit Matters podcast. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we'll be back with Philip in just a few minutes after this break.
Was it something I did in another life? I try and try, but nothing comes out right for me. Bad karma, killing me by degrees. I took a wrong
Okay, that's Warren Zevon singing Bad Karma from his album Sentimental Hygiene. We are talking to Philip Goldberg, author of the book Karmic Relief, Harnessing the Laws of Cause and Effect for a Joyful, Meaningful Life. One of the important points you make in the book, I think, is this notion that karma is not about reward and punishment, but it's an opportunity to grow spiritually. And I was wondering, can you talk a bit more about that?
Good. Thanks for that, because this part of it's one of the things, misunderstandings that I didn't get to. We think in terms of, you know, reward and punishment, as I say. The thinkers I admire in the Hindu and Buddhist traditions who explicate about karma will usually suggest that we don't think in terms of reward and punishment, that the model is not a judicial one, but more of an educational one. So karma is not here to punish us, but to teach us, is a quote from one of them. If we think of life as, or our lives as schools, karma is, you know, how the curriculum is arranged. And it's an independent study program where we essentially create our own curriculum. So what we do has effects, and when those effects come to us, we can learn from them and grow because of learning the right lessons, as opposed to, oh, I'm being punished or I'm being rewarded. Then it removes the element of judgment. It's just, this is the course I signed up for. What can I learn? How can I grow? And if I do learn and grow and change, I will behave differently and essentially pass the course and matriculate to another level of growth and development. We're always, you know, especially if we're on a spiritual path of some sort, we're wanting to constantly transform and be better humans and bigger humans and more fulfilled humans. And so that we learn lessons. And I think that's a healthier model than to think of karma as reward and punishment. Mm-hmm. It puts the responsibility on us to learn. And if we don't learn the lessons, we repeat our behavior and it'll come back to us again. And one hopes that at some point you think, why does this keep happening to me? And learn from that and do things differently.
In the book, you talk about the idea of being able to deposit good karma. I say good karma in our account. Does our attitude have anything to do with it? Can we be ill-tempered within ourselves yet still work to stack up good karma? Or does our attitude negate our attempts to store up good karma credits?
Good question, McNair. One of the things you realize when you dig into the details of karma as it's played out in the Eastern traditions is one of the things I've learned from them is they look at life, our individuality, in layers. So there's the layer of outer action and the world of the senses, the things we do. There's the things we say. And on a deeper level of causation, it's what we think and what we intend. You said attitude. What is our motivation? What is our character? What is our basic character? And even deeper, what is our state of awareness, our state of consciousness, which you can even think of in physical terms? What's the condition of our apparatus, our brains, our nervous system that give rise to our feelings and our attitudes and our thoughts and then our speech and then our action? And so the Eastern traditions address these things on those deeper levels, not just what we do. And it's very clear in those teachings, and it makes logical sense, that our thoughts create karma, our intentions create karma, So every tradition has certain values, certain ethical principles in common, in the obvious ways. You don't kill. You don't intentionally cause harm to others. You don't lie. You don't steal. But there are nuances. So if a mother has a hungry child and shoplifts to feed her child, it's a different karmic situation than somebody who goes in at gunpoint and robs the store, or somebody who, for fun, shoplifts, you know, a mischievous teenager or whatever. We might tell an untruth because we're being kind. Oh, you look so good today. We tell stories to our children. Oh, Santa will, you know, be kind, good to you. Those are untruths, but with good intent. Somebody who commits fraud is telling an untruth for bad intent. That's different karma.
So would it be like different karma as well? Like you mentioned about do not kill, but if a person's at war and they're killing, does their attitude have, when they're doing that, does that have something to do with the karma that's set up?
Theoretically, yes. And also, is it what we call a just war? Or is it a war of aggression and conquest? You know, of all the sacred texts and all the traditions, the one I keep returning to is the Bhagavad Gita. It's just had a big impact on me, and I teach about it and so forth. Those who are familiar with it know that, you know, one of the characters, so to speak, is Krishna, who represents the eternal wisdom of the divine. You could say he's an incarnation of God. And his student, so to speak, the main, you know, the protagonist is Arjuna, who's a warrior about to go into battle against very evil forces threatening his people. He has a duty to defend them because that's his role in life. He's a skilled warrior. But he doesn't want to kill, especially because the people on the other side, the bad guys, happen to be cousins and uncles. So whether it's a true story or made up, it's a brilliant device, because the advice he's given is not, well, go into a cave and be a yogi. It's, no, you have a duty to perform in the world. So, and in his case, it happens to be one that's going to require killing people, and injuring people in the defense of something good. So it's set up to be a righteous battle and a just war. But because Arjuna is in that a real life situation, we can all identify with it. In one way or another, we have responsibility to do good in the world. Even if it causes temporary harm, it's overridden by the larger cause. And we see that. We've all experienced it in our own histories. World War II was very different from Vietnam. And what's going on now, you know, history will judge. Was it a, you know, I have my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I don't operate the laws of karma. I'm not privy to God's will. But yes, so the circumstances and the collective karma and the intention. You know, the samurais, there's a great story about the samurais in Japan. They're warriors, but they operate under strict codes of behavior, just as one hopes our own military does and the police do. And there's a great story about a samurai who's he has to avenge the murder of his mentor, his teacher, And he goes hunting down the killer, and he finds him, and he lifts his sword, and he remembers he's not supposed to kill in anger. Mm. And so he goes away until he can collect himself and then do his duty, but not in anger.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
There's a lesson there,
yeah.
You know, for it. But let me add to that. If you're walking around with thoughts of revenge and fantasies of, you know, harming somebody who did you wrong, and you don't act on it, you're still reaping the reward, the karma of all that mental energy and the emotion of anger and revenge and everything else. It's not the same as if you harm that person physically, but it's there.
Our guest today is Philip Goldberg, author of the book Karmic Relief. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina.
Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Yajnyarthat Karmanonyatra Lokoyam Karma Bandhanaha Tadartham Karma Kaunteya Mukta Sangha Samachara Devan Bhavayatanena Te Deva Bhavayantu Vaha Parasparam Bhavayantaha Shreya Paramahansa.
Okay, that song's Karma Yoga by Sri Ganapathy Satchidananda Swamiji from an album Gita Gana. Philip, what's been the reception to the book?
Well, I don't look at sales figures, so I can't give you that. But it's been very gratifying to get emails from people, not even people I don't know, because the good emails from your old friends are, you know, you don't know if they mean it or not. But to get them from strangers is better. Thanking me for the book and helping them understand karma. It seems to be, when I give public talks or interviews, it seems to be well received. I'm pleased by that. And I hope, you know, it helps people in their lives. And so there are some indications that that's the case. And I hope, you know, at this age, you know, I'm trying to create good karma by focusing my work energies on things I think can be useful and make a contribution. Mm-hmm. So far, seems to be having mm-hmm. some good effect.
So, are there a couple of takeaways that you would hope people would get from reading the book?
Yes, I hope that, well, one thing is, this gets us back to another misunderstanding of karma. I hope they come to understand, if they are inclined to think in terms of karma and lean toward karma being a real thing, that cause and effect are in operation in our lives, I hope they take that seriously and adjust their attitudes, their thinking, their behavior to create good karma, not just for themselves, but I think that one of the best ways to create good karma is to do something of service and to do good things for other people. You can't go wrong with that. And to cultivate the compassion so that you're more inclined to do good in the world. I also hope they understand better that if karma is real, it's simple in certain ways. You reap what you sow. Everything has a cause and it'll come back to you. But it's also extremely complicated because human beings and their groupings are very complicated. And so I hope it alleviates from people who believe in karma the habit of trying to figure it out. Very often you see people will say, oh, this is happening because of the karma from the past. What did I do to cause this now? what was I in a previous life that causes this now? And they'll speculate about it and imagine and try to go back into the past. There, to do that to a certain extent makes sense. What might I have done to have this person be so mean to me? Maybe I can learn something. But to speculate and to think that what happens now had one cause in the past is a waste of time and foolish. Life is very complicated. But the main thing I want people to take away is whatever's happening in the past, accept it. It's real. Do something to alleviate whatever pain is going on. Celebrate whatever and be grateful for the good karma that comes to you. And be aware that in every moment you're planting seeds that will fructify in the future. And that's our responsibility. And we have a responsibility not just to ourselves and our own personal karma, but for those we care about and the civilization we're part of.
Did you learn anything in the process of researching and writing about karma that you didn't know before?
Yeah, thank you. I did. I thought it was simpler than it is. And I also thought there was much more uniformity of understanding about karma in the Eastern traditions. But there are many branches of Hinduism and many, you know, branches of Buddhism, and they have little nuanced differences of understanding and so forth that, you know, complicated my research. But I tried to simplify it so readers don't have to be bothered with all that academic stuff. So that was one surprising thing. And the other surprising thing was how, as I said earlier, one of the reasons I wrote it was because the idea of karma seems to have become part of the thinking, part of the worldview of so many more Americans than I thought was the case. Or I saw it, that was so, but it's even more so than I realized. I'll go to audience and I'll say, how many believe that in karma? How many believe karma is a real thing? Far more people raise their hands than I expected. I expected much more cynicism. Maybe it's just who shows up for a talk on karma. So it's not exactly a cross-section of humanity. But there's more openness to it, some sense that there are forces at work in the universe that are beyond our comprehension and that are bigger, you know, than what we can observe and measure. And we're not sure what that is. And for those who are not comfortable with a Judeo-Christian or a Western understanding of God and divine will, karma seems to be more satisfactory to more sort of secular, scientifically oriented people. But people recognize that there are forces in the world beyond our cognition, beyond the physical. And I think that's a good sign, you know, that it speaks to a spiritual growth that's more widespread than we might realize.
Okay, on that note, I want to thank Philip Goldberg for being with us today. And Philip, thank you so much for being with us, and all the best to you, and all the best with the book.
Thank you, McNair. It was my good karma to be with you.
This is karma's gonna get you. You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with John Lennon singing Instant Karma from the album The Very Best of John Lennon. Karma's gonna get you. Gonna look you right in the face. Better get
get yourself together, darling. Join the human race.